So first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for an opportunity to speak here. So this talk will be a little different from other talks in the sense it will be not about PDEs mostly, but it's about computability, but you'll see why I hope to convince you that it's interesting and important and related. Okay, so first of all, computing, so even the speakers today, you've seen that computing is important, solving real life problems, eventually we do something, but eventually we get to some numerical models and we use computers to solve them. And the other reason is that sometimes the bounding factor to front-end technology is not material constraints or any other constraints, but computational constraints. So, in the first part, I'll give a brief review of the general theory of computation. So, this theory is concerned about those are the main question it asks: what can be computed, how efficiently can it be computed, what cannot be computed, and so on. So an example of a typical question: can we factor an integer in time polynomial in its length? And as you might know, a positive answer to this question would imply that our RSA transactions are not secure. So, just as in any other part of math, in order to prove theorems, we need some model. And the most commonly used model of computation is the Turing machine. And you can think about it as an ordinary computer running any programming language, because all those models are proven to be equivalent. Okay. So a Turing machine is just an abstraction of the ordinary computer. The Turing machine operates on the set of finite binary strings, and its domain are all those strings, so the empty strings 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, and so on. What does it mean to decide or to compute a set on using the Turing machine? It just means that the machine running on this input W, if W is an L, it outputs 1. If it's not an L, it outputs 0. So, for example, the set of primes written in binary. If M decides the language primes, then M of 1, 0 is 1 because 2 is prime, and M of 1, 0, 0 is 0 because 4 is not prime. Now, the complexity of the problem, well, there are many ways to measure the complexity, but the time complexity is the amount of time the fastest Turing machine takes to decide the problem. So the time complexity of the primes has been recently shown to be polynomial in the length of the input. It's only just 2 years ago there has been a first non-randomized polynomial algorithm to decide primality, to test whether a number is a prime or not. Okay, so that was a brief summary of the discrete case. Now, what happens in the continuous case? How to define computability of continuous objects, functions, infinite continuous sets, and so on? The domain is now Rn, so it is uncountable, and it is in general impossible to represent real numbers on the computer, because any reasonable computer has countably many, even the idealized computer, which has a countable amount of cells, can only represent countable amount of different settings. Okay, so first of all, the first thing we define is the computability of real functions, and this is the this is a very common definition. I don't know how old it is. So given what do we want for, and that's what we do in everyday life when we compute, when you say that the program computes the sine function, for example. So given a good approximation of the input, we would expect a good approximation of the output of f of x. And the better approximation of f of x we would need to supply more bits of x and run longer. But that's how the computation works. The goal is to compute f of x with precision 1 over 2 to the n. The input is the precision parameter. M of f specifies how many bits of x would it like to see, and at 1 over 2 to the m approximation of x. The input gives us now a rational number, so we know how to represent rational numbers. Well, it's easy. It's definitely many bits. It gives a rational within this distance from x, and the machine is expected to give to compute f of x within the precision factor. Okay. Now, the same way we can measure complexity of discrete problems. Here, the complexity T of n is the time required to achieve precision 1 over 2 to the n. It can be thought of as the time required to compute the first n bits of the answer. So, and there are no surprises here. Some basic properties. Computable functions must be continuous. And intuitively, the reason is because we only ask for an approximation of x, of the input x, so we cannot expect to be able to distinguish small perturbations of x, so it should not depend on them, the function should not depend on them too much. And most common functions are computable in time polynomial in n, if you choose a proper domain where the function is nicely behaved. So polynomials, rational functions, trigonometric functions, exponential, so all the ordinary functions. But on the other hand, there are many uncomputable functions, even continuous functions, which are uncomputable. Okay, so the next step is to discuss computability of real sets. So let C be a subset of Rn. For simplicity, we assume that C is closed. And now the question is how to define a process of computing or deciding C. C is now, so it was very easy for a set of binary strings. We just, if the string is in the set, answer 1. If it's not, answer 0. But here, it seems much tougher. So the first attempt is to say that the set is computable if and only if its characteristic function is computable. But this is not a good definition, because only continuous functions can be computable in the first place, and the characteristic function is only continuous when C is either the empty or the whole set. So it's not a good definition, because all the sets are not computable, so it's not very informative. Okay, second attempt mimics the discrete case. So given an input x, try to output 1 if it's in the set and 0 if it's not in the set. The problem is, again, that x is a member of some uncountable Rn, and we cannot, it's unclear how to supply x as an input. Okay, the third approach, view Blum, Kaker, Schaub, and Smale, it's to use precise arithmetic, so we now allow our machines to represent numbers in one, real numbers in one unit of memory. But now we need to limit the operations we can do with those numbers. So we restrict ourselves to some set of operations. So here, for example, plus times. So basically, here it means that we allow polynomial constraints. So we allow to add the inputs, multiply them, say it's bigger than 0, equal to 0. So we allow polynomial constraints, and indeed it connects to algebraic geometry. The downside is that many intuitively computable sets that, if you think about it, they should be computable and not computable in this model. So for example, the Koch snowflake, it has a fractional Hausdorff dimension of log 4 over log 3, and so it's not computable in this model because it's hard to imagine it represented with set of polynomial constraints, and indeed it cannot be. And most hyperbolic Julia sets we'll talk about today are also not computable in this model for the same reason. Okay, the approach we are using here is, well, the intuition is to draw the set. So in order to draw the set, so we need to decide for each pixel whether we want to put it, whether we want to draw it or not. If the pixel intersects the set, for sure we want to put it in. If the pixel is far away from the set, we must not put it. And then when we put all the pixels we decide to put, we get a good picture of C. Okay, so here is a drawing of it. So if the pixel intersects the set, we answer yes. If twice the pixel doesn't intersect the set, we must not draw it because it's too far. And in the middle, we allow it to do anything, either to put it or not. So formally, we need to compute one function from this family. So given a rational, which is the center of this pixel, and n is the precision factor, is the radius of this pixel, we need to output 1 if the pixel intersects C, 0 if twice the pixel does not intersect C, and we are free to output whatever we want otherwise. It doesn't matter. Yeah, so indeed, it is a problem because we cannot choose. But I'm cheating a little bit here. It will not be a function because it depends on the presentation of this parameter Q. If you write 1/2 here as 0.49999, you might get a different answer than if you write it as 0.5. But we don't care because it's a don't care area. Okay? So it's not a function, and it's not a function from rational from R times Z. It's a function from all the presentations of R times Z. But the most important thing are the first two lines, and in the handout, it's the first definition. Okay, so now it's stated in terms of the function. Okay, now we take the union of all the pixels that output 1, and you see that those pixels must cover C, because every pixel that intersected C we threw in. And on the other hand, it has a small Hausdorff distance from C, so we don't include any points too far away from C in this picture. Okay, so it might look as if it's a very artificial computer graphics oriented definition, but in fact it's not. So an equivalent definition is a set is computable if and only if its distance function DC is computable. So you see that the previous one looked as if it was purely computer graphics, maybe with pixels. Here it's a purely mathematical statement about the distance function. But those two definitions are equivalent. And it's easy to see. Well, if you know how to compute the distance function, it's easy to see that you can tell us whether to put the pixel or not. Just compute the distance from the center of the pixel, and we know right away what's going on. In the opposite direction, it requires a little bit more effort. We just need to first draw a good picture of C, and then approximate this distance function with the other distance function from the picture. But they're equivalent. And the time complexity is of the set corresponds to the time to compute that function we've seen before. It corresponds to complexity of drawing a pixel of size 2 to the minus n. And low complexity, for example, polynomial in n, it means that we are good in, it's easy to zoom in, so it's almost as easy to decide tiny pixels as big pixels, and then if you want a very zoomed in picture, we can get it for fairly cheap. Okay, now there, here is a weaker definition. So before we required that if we look from the point of view of the center of the pixel, we require that if the center is 2 to the minus n close to the set, we must output 1, and if it's far, we must output 0. Now we only required that if it's in the set itself, we must output 1, and otherwise and if it's far, we output 0. So you see it's a weaker definition because now we get more freedom. And this is definition 3 on the handout. So what's happening is, so if this is C, this is twice 2 to the minus n, and this is 2 to the minus n. In the first definition, we would have output 1 here, 0 here, and also 1 for centers located in this part, and anything here. Now we relax the condition, we allow anything here as well. So it's a weaker definition, so on one hand, it's now easier to prove computability for this definition, but on the other hand, it's unclear whether they're equivalent. But indeed, they are equivalent from the computational point of view, but they are not equivalent from the complexity point of view. For example, a set is polytime computable in the first definition. If the two definitions are equivalent for polytime computability, it's equivalent to P is equal to NP. So it's very unlikely to happen. But also it's very unlikely that we will be able to verify it. Okay, so now to the Julia set. So a brief definition of the Julia set. So we consider an iterated complex map FC. This is the simplest degree 2 case. We consider an iterated map FC of Z, Z square plus C. So we take a point X and consider its orbit. The iterated sequence may or may not converge to a point, or to a limiting cycle, or to infinity. And the Julia set in this simple case is the boundary of the set of points such that the orbit converges to infinity. So a few examples. This is a very simple example we see as above, 0.2 minus 0.3i. And the Julia set actually is the boundary of this region. And so in this case, life is simple. In this picture, it probably has to do with the speed at which points from those rays diverge to infinity. Probably the darker orange diverges faster in a few less iterations, but all the points in the orange area eventually go to infinity. The second example, here it's a little bit more complicated. The Julia set now is the boundary of this set, and it's not a very good picture because from the theory, it follows that this point must be in the set, but it does not appear in the picture. The third example is C is 0.68i. In this case, almost all points converge to infinity, and the points where it doesn't happen, those are the points of the Julia set. And in this case, it's a counter set. All right, so a very special and nice kind of Julia sets are hyperbolic Julia sets. So the defining property is that points outside J converge either to an attracting cycle or to infinity. So in general, many more pathological behaviors might occur, but in this simple case, those are the only two cases. Either, well, actually there is only one case if you consider infinity as a fixed point, that any point outside of J must converge to an attracting cycle. And as of our knowledge, so first of all the points outside, Mandelbrot said, they correspond, if you view this plane now as the plane of parameter C, then any C outside in the purple area corresponds to a hyperbolic Julia set, and also all the known points in the interior of the Mandelbrot set correspond to hyperbolic Julia sets, and it's a major open problem whether all the points indeed correspond to hyperbolic Julia sets. But all the points that, like in this component or in any other component that we know about, satisfy this property. Definition, you consider the iterated, it has to do with the behavior of zero under the corresponding under this iterative map. So if zero, so you take C, C square plus C, C square plus C square plus C, and so on, and you see, so outside it goes to infinity, and probably just, yeah, and it doesn't, yeah. Okay, so briefly on the idea behind computing hyperbolic Julia sets. So now that we have this relaxed definition of computability, that we only need to distinguish between the case that X is in J in the Julia set, or that X is far away from J. Before, we had, in, with the first definition, we would have to distinguish between X is close to J and X is not very close to J. Now we have only to distinguish between X is exactly in J or X is not too close to J. So we use the fact that if X is not too close to J, then after relatively few iterations, X will run away. And if X is in J, J is invariant under this mapping, X, its orbit will stay there forever. And the way we do it, we introduce a new metric called the Poincaré metric. And it's equivalent to the Euclidean metric with some coefficients. And all this is computable. And the property is that it's strictly expanding near the Julia set. So in this metric, the distance expands by some constant bigger than 1 each time. So if initially x is 2 to the minus n far from j, after m steps, it will be 2 to the minus n times c to the m far from j. And so, after linearly many steps, it will become, after order of n steps, it will become order, the distance will become order of 1, and we will be able to measure it with some rough initial approximation. And on the other hand, if x is in j, then the orbit stays in j. So, this way, we manage to compute it with the third definition, with this weaker definition, but actually, it takes effort then, because that solves the problem of computability, but it takes effort to make it polytime, because this is polytime in the third definition, but to make it it's possible to make it polytime in the first definition, but it requires effort. Okay, so this was a brief presentation on Julia sets, but why is it, in conclusion, why is it what's the importance of real computability and complexity? So actually, it works two ways. So it helps us, because many real-life problems are discrete, like factoring, but many are continuous, so, and I don't need to tell it to you. So it should help us to understand our limitation in the ability to solve these problems numerically, for example. And the other interesting thing is challenging church thesis, which is also, well, it's possible. So the extended church thesis states that all physical computational devices have effectively the same computational power. So it's not a theorem. It's impossible to prove something like that because it's quantified over all physical devices. But if a problem takes polynomial time on device A, it also takes polynomial time on device B, where A and B are any computational devices. So it's obviously true for any computers because any two computers differ by a constant factor. So it's true for all computational devices currently in use, and apparently it's false for quantum computation, even though a quantum computer hasn't been constructed. But if it is to be constructed, apparently numbers can be factored fast on it, and we don't know how to do it on a traditional computer. Anyways, how could computational hardness of continuous problems help us with the Church thesis? So consider a physical system which leads to computationally hard problems. So for example, here we have some turbulence, or computationally hard or even uncomputable problem. So suppose one could prove that the system or one of its observables is computationally hard. That it's hard to predict it from initial conditions to the answer. Then the system is much stronger in solving itself than the standard computer. Well, okay, this is, well, it's interesting by itself, but it's not very surprising maybe that a glass of boiling water is much better in solving its equation than our computer simulations. But this would imply, formally it would imply that the system is incomparable with the standard computer because it can do things that the computer can't do and maybe vice versa, so it's probably incomparable. And potentially it might be stronger in solving some other interesting problems. So not just simulating itself. Okay, so and the connection to PDEs is that first of all, well, when we are discussing physical problems, we are discussing larger amount of time we discuss PDEs, which model those processes. The computability and complexity theory of PDEs, well, now, as of my knowledge, it's not very developed, so it's lots of opportunity for future research, and that's one of the reasons I'm speaking here. And in the opposite direction, well, computational complexity has evolved beyond definitions in past 30 or so years, so it's possible to help to understand some inherent hardness in PDEs, in numerical solutions. And some results. So first of all, there is a non-computability result for some wave equations. The problem, it depends on the metric. I think it's not computable in some metric, but it is computable in the energy metric. And also the n-body problem in Newtonian mechanics, it cannot be simulated for 1 second because of recently it has been shown that there could be non-collision singularities. So basically, in finite time, the system can perform infinite amount of motion, but of course it's only in the idealized Newtonian mechanics because it requires infinite velocities, infinite energies, and so it's not very realistic. But in this model, indeed, we can. If life was Newtonian, we would be able to maybe to do it. Okay, questions.